Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Coming up in this episode, we will be talking to Ramon Barthelemy, a physicist at the University of Utah, who has surveyed more than 300 LGBT plus physicists about the issues they face in their careers. We will also hear from the science writer Kate Revilius about CERN's first ever public environment report and the surprising source of the bulk of the lab's greenhouse gas emissions. But first, in the run-up to the Quantum 2020 virtual conference that will be held later this month, we are doing a series of interviews with some of the plenary speakers at the event. First up is a scientist who is helping Google build quantum computers. I'm joined down the line from California by Sergio Boixo, who is Chief Scientist, Quantum Computing Theory at Google AI. Hi, Sergio. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So the first question, I think that question that's on the mind of everyone, is why is Google developing quantum computers?
Well, quantum computing can accelerate solutions for some of the world's most important problems, for climate change to disease. And the reason is that nature is quantum mechanical, right? At a lower level, modern physics, modern chemistry is all quantum mechanical. And quantum computing will give us the chance to do simulations that are impossible to do right now. And when we are able to do that, we think we could apply it to all sorts of problems. For instance, in the context of climate change, we think we will be able to design more efficient batteries or create fertilizer using less energy. Right now, just that process consumes around 2% of the world energy, right? And a similar amount of CO2 emissions. And we think there is a better process to do that, but we're not able to find it because we cannot simulate the chemistry of that is used to create fertilizers. So these applications are still many years away, but we think is a potential for a fundamental change, for a new industrial revolution, more energy efficient. And I think that's the reason why Google is developing quantum computers.
Now Google has developed a quantum computing technology, the Sycamore processor, that is based on a superconducting qubit system. Can you describe that technology?
Sure. There are indeed several potential technologies to develop qubits. I will say superconducting qubits is right now the most popular. So what a superconducting qubit is basically a circuit made of superconducting material. So you can describe it as more or less as a regular circuit with some special elements, but it has, you know, capacitance and inductance. What it doesn't have is resistance. That's why it's made of a superconducting material. The reason why you don't have any resistance is because the main enemy to develop and scale quantum computers is noise, and a resistance create noise. Basically, electrons will be scattering away in uncontrolled manners, and that will destroy the quantum computation. So that's why these circuits are made of superconducting material. So what happens is the energy in these circuits, according to quantum mechanics, is quantized, right? So you have discrete energy levels. The separation between these energy levels is very tiny. So to be able to resolve them, to be able to see the discrete energy levels, you need to be at a very cold temperature, around 15 millikelvin, much, much colder than the transition to superconductivity. And that allows you to see the discrete energy levels. And once you're at that point and you see energy levels, then these circuits made of superconducting material, they kind of look at artificial atoms, right? They have discrete energy levels as an atom will do. So the main reason to use superconducting qubits, these artificial atoms, instead of just natural atoms, is that they are more controllable. They're easier to control than atoms. They are bigger, and you can control them with cables, and you can basically use all the technology that has been developed to fabricate chips, to fabricate the superconducting chips with superconducting qubits. So we leverage on all the technology, and we end up with these artificial atoms that are quite controllable. The problem is this is a solid material. The qubits are very, very big by, you know, quantum mechanical standards. So they are fairly noisy, and that's something we're working hard on. Other companies and labs, you know, working hard to reduce the noise in these artificial atoms made of superconducting materials.
Because that's the bane of doing a quantum computation, isn't it? The noise that destroys the quantum nature of the qubit.
Correct. Yeah, there are the two main axes to develop quantum processors are noise and scalability. So uncontrollability, which is related to scalability. So you want to have many qubits. You want to be able to control them very accurately to do exactly the operations that you want to do. And you need to have very reduced levels of noise. If there is noise, any sort of discrete noise can destroy the quantum computation. It kind of collapses the computation. It collapses the wave function.
And Sergio, your background is in theoretical physics and computer science. What is the role of theorists and indeed computer scientists in developing quantum computing technologies?
Right. So we're still at the earliest stages of quantum computing. So there are many roles for theorists because this is, you know, a nascent technology with many research problems that we have to address. So some of the problems we address as theorists is to develop new algorithms and potential uses for quantum computers, because this is a completely new way of doing computations, right? We don't have that much experience what kind of computations we can accelerate and how to write algorithms. So that's something very important as we work very hard to develop new quantum computers and eventually a fault-tolerant quantum computer. It's also very important that the algorithms are ready and the applications are ready or as ready as possible, right? So we have to develop kind of with pen and paper new algorithms. And now we have already the first experimental quantum processors. They are not really quantum computers because they do have noise. The computations have to be very short, but it's already allowing us to experiment with new algorithms in the quantum processors we have in the lab, and you can access sometimes, you know, through the internet, right? Other things we do, well, in the short term, we need to control noise, not only at the hardware level. So theorists will also work with experimentalists to try to come up with new ideas, how to reduce noise in hardware and sometimes new qubit designs or new calibration methods, but also at the algorithmic level. So there is the theory of quantum error correction, which is becoming the practice of quantum error correction, that will allow us to build a fault-tolerant quantum computer, basically a quantum computer that just works forever until you switch it off without any errors. For that, you need quantum error correction. And also error mitigation. So that's a shorter term way of dealing with errors. Instead of correcting them, you want to at least find out if there was an error in the computation so you can try the computation again, and you just try many times until there are no errors. This is not as scalable as error correction, but it requires less resources. So we think in the near term, this is probably the technology we need to be able to make really impactful near-term applications before we have fault-tolerant quantum computers.
Recently, scientists at Google used Sycamore to calculate the electronic structure of a molecule. Do you see computational chemistry as an important early application of quantum computers?
Yes, I think it's likely that computational chemistry and computational physics will be the first impactful application of quantum computers. And the reason is that chemistry and physics is quantum mechanical, right? We know the correct equations for any molecule, let's say, or most materials, which is, you know, just a quantum mechanical equation. The problem is we cannot solve it and we cannot simulate it. So we know what is the equation of any molecule for more than 100 years already, but there is little we can do with it in many cases. So nevertheless, quantum mechanics already had a huge impact in technology. For instance, we have semiconductors, we have chips, right? And to develop semiconductors and develop new chips and the technology that we have around us, basically all the technology, lasers, things like that, from the second half of the 20th century, most of it is based in quantum mechanics, but only in cases where we have simple models that will describe the problem, what is called mean field theories. So it's quantum mechanical, but it works in a very simplified regime where we have kind of classical equations. But in more complicated cases, from things like catalyst, for instance, or superconductivity, which don't have these very simplified solutions, then we're kind of in the dark. And the way you develop new chemistry, new catalyst, or new molecules in pharmacology is still basically trial and error, right? So we know the equations, but we cannot solve the equation. We cannot simulate it. Once we have a quantum computer, because the quantum computer is itself evolving according or computing, right, according to the rules of quantum mechanics, we will be able to simulate quantum chemistry and quantum physics. So this will expand the region of materials and molecules we can work with. And I think this is likely to give rise to a new industrial revolution, right? Like in quantum mechanics gave rise to the technological revolution of the second half of last century with things like semiconductors. I think that once we have quantum computers, there will be a new industrial revolution with a new, more efficient processes to develop chemistry and exotic materials.
And what are some other problems that you plan to tackle with Sycamore?
Well, Sycamore is still an experimental quantum processor. It has low errors by current standards, but still the errors are higher than where we would like them to be to scale up to, you know, a fault-tolerant quantum computer, which is the dream in 10 years to have a fault-tolerant quantum computer that basically works without any errors because you're doing quantum error correction, right? So that's the goal. We think that's possible to do in 10 years, but we still have to lower the errors. And Sycamore is a very good platform to study errors and new techniques to lower errors, new algorithmic techniques like error mitigation, but also variations in designs of superconducting qubits and variations in control and calibration to reduce errors. So I think that's one of the main focuses with Sycamore, and also develop these new error mitigation techniques, so algorithmic techniques to deal with errors in the near term without necessarily correct them, but at least remove them from the computation just by trying many times. And as we develop these new algorithmic techniques, then we're hopeful that we will have beyond classical simulations even before we have a fault-tolerant quantum computer. Probably first, these beyond classical simulations will be for physical models, and later perhaps we can try to do this beyond classical quantum chemistry simulations even before we have a fault-tolerant quantum computer.
Currently, Sycamore has 54 quantum bits or qubits. What are the challenges involved in integrating more qubits, and how many qubits will your next generation quantum processor have?
So yes, in principle, superconducting qubits are microfabricated with, you know, a similar technology that is used for standard chips. So you can build a chip with more qubits. There are still problems related to control. You need very specialized classical electronics, but it's quite specialized to control these qubits. You need packaging, right? You need to get all the cables in your quantum processor. But the main problem is not really adding more qubits. The main problem is to reduce the errors, right? And we feel that, yeah, we probably will grow the size of our chips with some more qubits, but the main goal is to iterate the design and the control of superconducting qubits to reduce the errors. And that's probably done better at, you know, not a huge size, but a similar size to Sycamore, or maybe a bit larger.
Thanks for being on the Physics World Weekly podcast, Sergio.
Thank you for having me.
You can hear more from Sergio at the Quantum 2020 virtual conference, which is running from the 19th to the 22nd of October. The registration deadline is the 16th of this month, and there is no registration fee. Now, if you're a physicist who's part of the LGBT plus community, chances are you face some kind of unpleasant harassment or exclusionary behavior. To learn more about the day-to-day experiences of LGBT plus physicists, Ramon Bartholomew, an assistant professor of physics at the University of Utah, has recently carried out a survey of more than 300 LGBT plus physicists and has written up the findings in a new paper in the European Journal of Physics. Bartholomew talks about the paper with Physics World's Mateen Durrani.
So I'm delighted to be joined by Ramon Bartholomew, who's a physicist at the University of Utah. And he's just written a paper for EJP about a survey that he carried out about to find out more about exclusionary behavior and harassment among the LGBT plus community in the US physics community. Hi, Ramon. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Before we start, I mean, you're at the University of Utah. Do you want to tell us a bit about who you are and what you do there in terms of your teaching and your research?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. Thank you. So I'm Ramon Bartholomew. I'm an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah. I was hired here just last year, and I started the first ever physics education research group in the department here. All of my work looks at issues of equity, diversity, and inclusion in the field of physics, with a focus on workforce development and practical policies to help these groups be successful. And I have a number of projects going on, and one of them is the work that I did with the American Physical Society and a bunch of other wonderful folks, such as Tim Atherton and Elena Long and Savannah Garman, on LGBT plus physicists. So that's the paper we're chatting about today.
Yeah. So that paper, it's now an accepted manuscript in EJP. And so you did a survey of physicists in the US. Do you want to tell me a bit about how you did the survey and kind of how many people responded to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the survey was actually international. So the bulk of the participants actually did come from the United States, but we did send it out as broadly as possible. But since we did it through the American Physical Society, there was a natural bent towards the United States. But we sent it out through snowball sampling. So we used a listserv from the LGBT plus physicists grassroots group, which was founded by Dr. Elena Long a number of years ago. We used their listserv, sent it out to them, and then we did what is known as snowball sampling, where we asked them to send it out to their contacts, who are also part of the LGBT plus community. And in all, we had 324 responses, which I thought was actually quite good for the first attempt ever at trying to understand the experiences of LGBT physicists. And within that, we can split up the LGB with the T, so our transgender colleagues. And roughly 10%, about 37 participants were from the transgender community. And that was a really important part of the survey as well.
So it was a qualitative survey. So, I mean, obviously it consisted of written comments mostly. But I mean, what were the main findings? Can you sort of summarize it in any sense of?
We collected both quantitative and qualitative data. So the article that was just accepted to EJP, which I was very excited about, is an analysis of all the qualitative responses to the quantitative questions. But the findings were pretty stark, but I think they were also very informative for creating policies and thinking about LGBT plus experiences moving forward. So we found that of the 324 participants that we surveyed, roughly 36% had considered leaving in the last year. And a variety of different responses came out when it came to the experiences and observations of exclusionary behavior, which includes the experience of harassment. So we found that in the overall sample, about a fifth of participants reported experiencing harassment. However, this changed dramatically based on the gender and the trans identity of participants. So our trans colleagues reported experiencing harassment at a rate of 50%. Whereas gender nonconforming folks reported harassment at a rate of 42%, LGBT women reported a rate at 31%, and then LGBT men reported a rate of 11%. So what we found was that the experiences of harassment or exclusionary behavior were very different based on people's gender and also their identity as being transgender, which was an important finding because that suggests to us that intersectionality is really important in these findings because it's not just the LGBT identity that is impacting people. It's also their gender.
So in terms of that harassment, can you kind of give an example or a few examples of how it manifests itself? Is it in spoken comments? Is it in terms of career progression? Is it in terms of behavior in the laboratory or what sort of things?
That is a great question. The paper in EJP actually really delves into this. It manifested itself in many different ways, and it came differently for different people. So the bulk of the harassment exclusion behavior came in the forms of comments about people's dress, comments about people's sexuality, misgendering, so using the wrong pronouns with people. And we also saw a lot of experiences coming from exclusion. So it wasn't just that folks were being directly harassed. It was that they weren't being included in research projects. They weren't being included in the development of research proposals and other activities that were going on campus. And even some people spoke of exclusion when it came to social interactions. So even though colleagues might talk to them on campus, they were never invited out when there was an assistant professor gathering or something like that. We also found that the more pernicious forms of harassment, exclusionary behavior were also present. They were present at lower rates, thankfully, but they were there, which included physical touching, sexual harassment, very direct sexual harassment, and other experiences. And we did a pretty sharp write-up in the EJP article that's coming out soon, where we give block quote examples and we break down exactly how all the comments from the 71 people of the 324 that submitted comments about their experiences.
I mean, were you surprised in any way at those kind of comments you got? Were you shocked? Was anything that really stood out and took your breath away in terms of what you heard from people?
You know, there's always stuff that takes your breath away, which are the most egregious examples. And of course, most egregious examples are always physical touching and actual assault. It's shocking that this is still happening in particularly in the LGBT community. But in some sense, what's actually more shocking is the ubiquity of comments and misgendering, because those are the day-to-day slights that really do cause harm to physicists' careers. You know, it's as the old quote goes, it's death by a thousand paper cuts. So it's not just that one horrible traumatic event, which obviously we need to prevent and stop. It's the continued exposure to comments and denigration and misgendering and rudeness and exclusion that over a 30-year period can really have a differential impact on members of the LGBT plus community. So to me, I feel that is probably the most concerning and one of the more important things we should focus on because it affects the most number of people.
I mean, it's from what you say, it sounds terrible and, you know, quite shocking. I mean, do you think the experience of physicists within the physics community is different or worse to the sort of wider community? Would these things happen elsewhere, or are they more intense within a physics department?
That's a really good question. And I think as a scientist and as a survey scientist, I really have to respond by saying we don't know. because the reality is the survey that we have was really limited to the physics community. So from the results we have, I can speak to the physics community's experiences, but it's not really possible for me to speak to the broader STEM community because we just don't have that data. So I'm not really able to say, but what I can say is that we have definitely discovered issues in the physics community. And to me, that is evidence that we need to set forth policies and activism to remedy them.
And was there anything that you kind of felt positive about? Are there any sort of, you know, any good news coming out of this survey that, you know, we could see changes happening and anything that you can, you know, feel we're going in the right direction?
Yeah. You know, I would say the biggest thing that is really positive about the survey was the response we got from many members of the physics community and also the response that we got from the American Physical Society, because as part of this survey, we recommended six policy initiatives that we outlined in the LGBT Climate and Physics Report that we published with the American Physical Society. And a number of those policy recommendations have actually been put in place. So for example, one of the policy recommendations we made was the creation of a group formally recognized through the American Physical Society focused on diversity and inclusion. And we specifically said we wanted the group focused on diversity and inclusion and not just the LGBT community, because we wanted to be able to react to the changing landscape of identities and also to the experiences that other groups might bring up that they're having in the physics community, and wanted to be able to include their voices. So I'm really happy that this, what we call forum, has taken off in the American Physical Society. I'm luckily a member at large on it, and I'm looking forward to some of the good work that we might be able to do for it. And the fact that it focuses on diversity and inclusion largely really is grounded in the results of the survey. Because a lot of the survey results that we followed up with some interviews found that people's identities as being Black, Indigenous, or people of color, people's identities as being trans, people's identities as being women or gender nonconforming really intersected with their LGB identities. So what we found is that when we think about diversity, equity, and inclusion in physics, we have to think more broadly, and we have to think about all of the identities that people have and that come together in their expression of themselves, but unfortunately can have negative impacts on how other people view them and how other people treat them.
Yeah, but that's a very good point. And I mean, do you have a message to physicists who are listening who maybe never experienced this kind of harassment? Or maybe, you know, some people think, well, it doesn't even exist. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I missed the first part of your question, but I can definitely answer the second part of your question of what I would say to people who don't think that this work exists. And, you know, unfortunately, when we rolled the survey report out in 2016, we ourselves got a lot of harassment on Facebook through the American Physical Society's Facebook page. So incredibly derogatory, vulgar comments. And the chair of the committee pointed out that it was a bit ironic because there are many physicists that say that there aren't problems for the LGBT community or for other communities of color, Black, Indigenous folks, women in the community. But then when we even try to talk about it, we're met with vitriol and hate, unfortunately. And what I would tell to a physicist really is two things. So number one, quoting one of my colleagues, you know, you never know what people are going through, so always be kind to one another. That's incredibly important. Always be kind to one another. And the second thing that I would say is when we do the statistical modeling of the survey, and this is actually a new paper that I'm shortly going to submit to the EJP. So you're actually getting a first scoop on it. But what we find in the results when we build climate models using linear regression with the survey data, the quantitative survey data, we find that a lot of participants are positively impacted by the positive experiences that we're finding. So the conclusion that we came to was that it's not enough to have a neutral environment in a physics department or a physics community. You have to have an actively positive environment and an actively inclusive environment in order to create a space that's inclusive of everyone. So not to put too fine of a point on it, but we all have to be active in our efforts to be inclusive and inviting to all members of the physics community, particularly LGBT plus people, if we want to recruit and retain the amazing talent that exists in, you know, all the populations.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, you know, really powerful message. And yeah, thanks for expressing that. So one final thing, I mean, what are you planning? Any further surveys, any further analyses? What's your next steps?
Yeah, absolutely. I can talk about the next steps with this. And then I'd also be happy to talk about the broader work that I do on gender, race, and inclusion in my research group. But I'll start with the LGBT stuff. So right now, my colleagues and I, Dr. Tim Atherton at Tufts and Dr. Ben Pollard at the University of Colorado Boulder, we are writing a follow-up grant to the National Science Foundation here in the States. So our goal is to rerun this survey, but you know, half a decade later, and see how things have changed. And part of the new survey that we're hoping to get funded and launch is that we want to put a stronger emphasis and focus on the transgender community, as well as Black, Indigenous, and other people of color in physics who also identify as LGBT. Because what we found in the interviews in the original survey was that those identities had a strong impact on people's experiences. So we really want to put their voices forward and focus on them in the new work. And as far as the broader research that I'm doing with my group, PERU, the Physics Education Research Group at the University of Utah, I have a number of projects. Right now, I'm primarily focused on graduate education. So I have one funded project that I'm working with a wonderful postdoctoral scholar, Dr. Mackenzie Lenz, on the implementations of holistic graduate admissions in our department, and also new mentoring structure that we have put in place in order to support our graduate students, which is fairly unique compared to the many programs that exist across the country. We're also building a theory of change about how we came to this new program. Another project that I have that is also funded by the National Science Foundation that I'm working with Dr. Miguel Rodriguez here at the University of Utah. He's a wonderful postdoctoral scholar with my group. We are looking at the experiences of people of color, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color as they go through graduate STEM education programs. So this is not specifically looking at physics. It's looking at the broader STEM community, but we're trying to understand what are the challenges and barriers, and also what are the supports and the moments of success that students are having at large Research One institutions, which in the United States are large Research One institutions, are primarily white. So the experiences of a Black, Indigenous, or person of color as a graduate student might be very different than their peers because, unfortunately, they're not surrounded by many people that come from the same background as them, look like them, same culture, same language. So the work that we're doing more broadly in PERU is to focus on diversity and inclusion really at every level, but also every kind that you can think of.
Sure. Well, it sounds fantastic work, and all power to your elbow with that. I wish you all the very best with that.
Thank
it sounds
you.
Really, really worthwhile and promising and really, really valuable work. So thanks for joining us on Physics World. And hopefully we can speak again in future when you've got some more findings and talk to us again about your work. So thanks, Ramon.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me. And I would love to talk again sometime. Thank you.
That was Mateen Durrani in conversation with Ramon Barthelemy. And do check out the paper in the European Journal of Physics, which you can access via IOP Science. The CERN Particle Physics Lab near Geneva has released its first public environment report, which revealed that the facility released nearly 224,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent greenhouse gases in 2019. I'm joined down the line from York by the science writer Kate Revilius to talk about the report. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Hamish.
So I can remember 20 years ago when the Large Hadron Collider was being built at CERN, the lab would actually brag about how much electricity it would consume as a way of illustrating the collider's scientific power. Given that this is the first public report on emissions, do you think that labs like CERN have been late to the table when it comes to discussing sustainability?
Well, it's interesting because I had a little look around and on average, apparently, research labs consume around 10 times more energy than the average office space. So labs generally are really energy intensive places to be. And I'm not sure. I mean, a certain number of labs are starting to address sustainability. But when I had a look, there's an organization called My Green Lab in the States that do help with sort of doing environmental assessments. But only 200 labs across North America have signed up with them. And here in the UK, we have something called the Laboratory Efficiency Assessment Framework. And again, only 16 universities are part of that pilot scheme. So I think certainly research labs are starting to do sustainability assessments, but it's not as widespread as we might hope. And so CERN might not be the earliest adopters to do this, but yeah, I mean, it's great that they've done it. And they've also done it in a really comprehensive and rigorous way, which is a really good thing.
To me, perhaps the most surprising aspect of the report is that the release of fluorinated gases account for about 78% of CERN's greenhouse gas emissions. So not gases associated with generating energy, but I suppose gases associated with the experiments that are done there. So what are these gases used for, and can these emissions be cut?
Yeah, I was absolutely staggered by this too. Yeah, so a quarter of their emissions are from the electricity and energy, and the other three quarters are the fluorinated gases. What these gases are used for are they're used in the particle detection process, and they're also used for the cooling. So CERN have to cool their superconducting magnets to -271.3°C, which is colder than outer space. And in order to do that, they have to use things like all these different fluorinated gases. When they were planning the Large Hadron Collider and building it back, it opened in 2008, their concern then was not to use CFCs, which we know damage the ozone layer. So they weren't, at that time, there wasn't an awareness of how damaging these gases were in terms of being greenhouse gases. So the lab was built with this in mind and using these gases to do the cooling. It now turns out that those gases are 23,000 times more, have more greenhouse warming potential than carbon dioxide. So wow. they that is why it is such an immense part of the greenhouse budget for CERN. In terms of what they can do, the Large Hadron Collider is... It's down at the moment, and they are refurbishing and repairing and things. And they're working really hard to repair all the leaks, which is a big part of the problem. So they're repairing all the leaks on it. They're optimizing all the gas recirculation systems to make it much more efficient. And they are looking into replacing some of these gases that do the cooling with carbon dioxide, which sounds quite ironic to be using carbon dioxide as the better thing, but that will actually improve things a lot. So yes, they can do something about it. And they've set themselves a really clear target. They want to reduce their overall greenhouse gas emissions by 28% by the end of 2024.
In an article that you wrote for Physics World about the CERN report, you liken the emissions to that of a large cruise liner. Is that a fair comparison given the huge scope of scientific, technological, and medical advances made at CERN? I mean, is it fair to, you know, compare it to a floating casino and buffet?
No, as a direct comparison. I use that because it's something we can all picture, but absolutely they are two very, very different things. And when I spoke to an expert in sustainability, Professor John Barrett, he said to me, that he personally would prefer to see our carbon budget spent on the kind of experiments that you see happening at CERN than on, in his words, were short, high-impact flights for a drunken weekend in Prague, but you could substitute cruise liners instead. So they're very different things. But I was also, as a comparison, it's quite staggering, you know, how much energy one lab can use. And so it's a useful way of just, you know, using it as a comparator, I think.
Do you see this as a problem in the future where, you know, let's say scientists want to build a replacement for the LHC, the next generation of particle physics experiments, or maybe they want to build a synchrotron or a large neutron scattering facility, that when you sort of add up all the, you know, sort of the concrete used to build the facility and all the resources needed to make the specialized equipment and the energy that it takes to run, you know, that's going to be a huge number. And is there a worry? I mean, I suppose I would have a worry that, you know, maybe a government that's looking not to spend money on science would take a look at this carbon footprint and say, well, hold on, you know, sorry, you're not going to get a new LHC because, you know, for carbon reasons, you know, it'll be used as an excuse, let's say, not to spend money on science.
Yeah, well, I think now everything we do is being approached in a much more analytical way about the energy use and sustainability associated with it for every new project, and much tougher questions are asked of new projects. And I know that they are already thinking about the next generation of LHC. And the great thing is that we have developed so many ways of making things far more efficient and using more sustainable materials. So I think with trying harder, we can get a long way in the way that we build things. And there are labs like the Francis Crick Institute in London, which have been a fantastic example of that. You know, it's a huge biomedical research institute that was built recently, but they have an on-site combined heat and power system. They have banks of solar panels on their roof. They're really an example of energy efficiency, you know, to its nth degree. So I think that research labs, even ones like CERN, will be able to, in their next generation, make big savings and justify their existence. But you're right that questions, you know, they will have to work harder to justify that existence, I think.
So, Kate, you mentioned that that CERN is working really hard to reduce the fluorinated gases that are emitted from the facility. But are they also looking at energy consumption as well?
Yes, they are. So a quarter of their emissions come from the electricity consumption. And their electricity consumption is equivalent to about the electricity consumed by 300,000 UK homes. So somewhere like the city of York, it's about the same electricity consumption. It's quite a lot. And when they're looking at reducing that electricity consumption, they are focusing on making things more efficient. And they're also looking at the sources that their electricity comes from. So they're trying to make sure that it comes from renewable sources of electricity, and they think they can go quite a long way in making some cuts there. So not using coal-fired power stations and so on.
Now, CERN's report is online. Kate, would you recommend that people take a look at it? Is it accessible?
Yeah, so I think particularly any other lab or organization that's thinking about doing their own energy assessment or sustainability report, it's well worth having a look at what CERN have done. It's laid out in a really accessible way, and it shows that they've been very comprehensive. They've not only looked at energy and greenhouse gas emissions, but they've also looked at their waste flows, the amount of noise pollution they make, the water use, the biodiversity locally, their environmental compliance, all sorts of things. So, and they've totted up the figures for all of those, and they've set themselves absolute reduction targets rather than sort of the greenwashed style targets where you reduce your impact per percentage of profit or whatever. I think it's a good model. It shows a way of approaching this problem. So even if they are a lab that uses an awful lot of energy and produces a lot of emissions, they're leading the way here in showing us how to tackle the problem.
You can read more about this report in Kate's article on the Physics World website. Look for the headline, CERN's Emissions Equal to a Large Cruise Liner, says report. Thanks for being on the podcast, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Kate Revilius, Ramon Bartholomew, Sergio Boixo, and Mateen Durrani for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.